I want to start with a news flash. The election is over. There are some good things about that. Yes, the telephone calls have diminished significantly. The campaign ads are being put away. Advertising in its various forms is returning to normal. Whether that's a good thing, I don't know, but it's the case. Some may still be adjusting to the implications of what the election now means, but we're working on that. There's been a lot of rhetoric, a lot of spilling of words, a lot of money has been spent on advertising. The thought occurred to me, what if we took all that money and put it toward the national debt? Would that have been of any help? Although it does stimulate the economy because all of the advertising companies, television companies, radio, they are, you know, really appreciative of having all of that extra help. Many of us feel like this when it comes to the fact that the ads are done. No, the fact that we had to endure the ads. Just kidding. And the reality is, not much has changed. We still have a lot of the same people. For all of the effort and all of the money that has been changed, that has changed hands, most of the same people are in leadership. We're still on the same course, perhaps with slightly more momentum. Maybe even a greater level of urgency in some ways, but the problems are now bigger. There's a pretty big one right here. People are more divided than ever. Just been reminded of that. The pile of things that need to be addressed is bigger because nobody's done anything for the last while because they've been focused on the election. So that's, oh yeah, we got to take care of that. Let's see, oh wait, Thanksgiving's coming and then Christmas. We don't have time to work on that stuff. So let's just wait till after the first of the year. So we have what the majority wants. Question is that what is best? It's interesting that the nation of Israel had some similar issues. They also put their vote in for something that may not have been the best thing for them, but they thought it was best at the time. So I want us to, as we're examining Old Testament characters, I want to examine a couple of Old Testament characters today and give some consideration to their responses and some consideration to the situation that they were dealing with. Because I think it may give us some insight into ourselves, into our own situation. So we want to be thinking about Saul and Samuel. And we want to think about, what does it look like when a nation wants to go its own way and rejects God? What does that look like? Is that a good thing? A lot of people think that's the way we want to go. We don't need God anymore. We've got things figured. We can explain things by purely naturalistic explanations. And it's okay. We don't have to deal with that. So, there may be a concern for a certain type of leadership. First Samuel 8:1 says, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel." And I know you're wondering how I got this picture of Samuel. I had to look hard. The names of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his second was Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. But the operative word here is that Samuel was old. He had been the judge for a number of years. He had grown up in the temple, as you recall, under special circumstances. And he had been the final judge in the list of judges, not listed in the book of Judges, but he was essentially a judge continuing the last part of that 400-year period of time when the judges were ruling things. And so there's a caveat here, though. While his sons were made judges, there was some concern expressed. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you are old." Now, I don't know if I'd like to hear it put like that. My children remind me of that from time to time. And we're not always appreciative, although it's true. But more so with Samuel. "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways." In other words, we don't like what we see in terms of the anticipated leadership that's coming down the pike. So, now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. And whether it was the concern relating to the sons that was the biggest issue, or whether it was a matter of wanting what everybody else had because that looked good, we're not told. But at least it was seemingly a combination of those things. The concern may stem from observed deficiencies, as was the case here. The circumstance of a leader may be a concern. In this case, it was Samuel. Samuel was old. They knew that a new leader was needed, and the behavior of his sons was a problem. The behavior of leaders may be a concern. We have similar things. Circumstances of a leader may be a concern. We either appreciate where they're coming from, or we don't, or what their circumstance is, or we recognize that they have the potential of being a good leader, or they're not going to be a leader for long, or the behavior of leaders may be a concern, all of which are issues today. We certainly have plenty of observed deficiencies in our world as we're thinking about leadership. A lack of moral character, lack of capability, a faulty mentality or ideology. We see a real change in things where we had been built on a traditional Judeo-Christian worldview and mindset over the last 50 plus years, we have seen an emphasis or a move to a progressive mindset. And this progressive mindset says times, they are a-changing, and we need to change with the times. We're no longer living in the age that the forefathers had in view as they put together the Constitution. Therefore, we need to adjust things and make these changes. That is where many are coming from today. Not long ago, I had a discussion with one of my brothers who happens to be leaning, no, that's putting it mildly, is in the camp of the progressives. And I'm thinking, how could that be? I know why. I know all the circumstances. But he's not easily dissuaded from that perspective. So it's a mindset, it's an ideology that we have to deal with. So we need to keep these things in mind. We have to recognize what we're dealing with. We have seen what the majority has decided they want for whatever reason, even though there are some gross inconsistencies in the way it seems some people must have voted, because their belief system says one thing and the way they voted said something else. And we wonder, what about that? How do you put that together? So we have this significant division that's going on, and yet we have to live with what we have. And here we are. So there are some who see deficiencies perhaps differently than others. And we would look at some from one perspective. The other side looks at it from a completely different perspective. We need to recognize that. So the continuing response, now being reminded of the last verse, "Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." So when we see the kinds of things that we see happening, we should recognize that it is a rejection of the ultimate authority of God. Even if they may not see it that way, though many would say, "Well, of course, yeah, we don't believe in him at all anyway, so why even bother?" And I'm diligently pushing the button and it's not turning. The concern may stem from contemporary expectations. And that certainly may be the case. What do we see as what we want to see happen in our contemporary world? What is our viewpoint? There may be a dissatisfaction with the present situation. When the children of Israel saw that Samuel's time was getting short and that his sons were not people that they wanted to have leading them, they were looking around at other options and thought that there was something else that they wanted. 4 years ago, there was a concern for hope and change. And some would say, now we have neither. Others would say, well, we're making progress, depending on where you're coming from. And this desire to have what others have, it's interesting when you think about that, because we are, in essence, putting ourselves under something very similar to what the children of Israel were doing. Because they were looking at putting themselves under a monarch, someone who had greater control, a centralized government, if you will, and bigger government, and we are in the process of doing that same thing. Now, I'm not here to talk politics per se, but I'm putting it in perspective as we look at this passage and think through some of these matters. Some would like us to adopt a more European model, because that seems appealing to some, but not to others. But then all you have to do is look at Europe and see how well they're doing. And you think, well, I'm not sure that's the way to go. And there are some who think that there are no other nations with a better system of government than what we have. And there is some truth to that. Although God can come up with a better idea, a theocracy, where he is actually ruling over things, that will come to pass again. Then looking at verse 8, "According to all the works which they have done, since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also." In other words, there's been a way of doing things that's been a part of their experience, and that continues on. The concern may stem from particular dispositions. The disposition of the people. They have been known to be fickle, to have inconsistent desires, a bent toward evil, difficult to please. They have been prone to complain, and they've been prone to forget God. Sound familiar? I think we have a little bit of that going around still in our own world. And then there's the disposition of leaders. Where are they coming from? What is their mindset? We look at Samuel. Samuel was devoted to God. He had given his life to him. But he was losing his influence. And there were some other issues as well. Saul was going to be the new leader, but he was a neophyte. He was not firmly committed to God. And a leader is needed who genuinely affirms allegiance. And as we think about it, God puts leaders in place to bless or to punish. Makes us wonder where we are. What is our current situation? And it's not moving again. There we go. I may need help if this thing's not going to be cooperative. There may be a clear warning of potential oppression. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them. In other words, God told Samuel, they are rejecting me. They are asking for a king. Go ahead and do what they say. But tell them, warn them what is going to happen and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. Because it has serious implications. So a solemn warning is given. And we have been given warning, though not everyone necessarily may pay attention to it. So we should anticipate some impacting demands. If we look at chapter 8 and beginning at verse 11, it says, "And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. Will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some will make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants." So, that sounds a little bit like bigger government to me. A demand for service, a demand for resources, and the more that you create, the more you have to have to continue to perpetuate that. A demand for time, a demand for taxes, because you have to support all of that which is put into place. It's another form of wealth distribution. And so on. And the question is, the children of Israel were told this. They were reminded. It was spelled out to them. And they still said, that's fine. And so it's a matter of giving up freedom for something. What is it that you're getting? A sense of security? A sense of feeling like, okay, everything's taken care of for you? Is it laziness on their part? Interesting to think about. What exactly is to be gained in that process? And then we read, "And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." After you have gotten what you think you want, then you're going to realize, oh, we're kind of stuck now. Now what can we do? Anticipate some intensification with time. It may start off not being as traumatic. The problems may not manifest themselves immediately. It may take place over a process of time more gradually. And not everyone sees things the same way. Some may see the provision, the fact that the government handles everything and does everything for you. That's the way we want to go. Others will say, wait a minute, I lose my freedom in the process. I'm not sure this is a good idea. Verses 19 and 20, it says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, even after they had heard this. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, and that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" We want our government to take care of us and to do stuff for us. Now, does that sound familiar? It was an acquiescence to dependency, essentially. The result will be oppression. There is a quote that is familiar to you. This is from Professor Alexander Tyler, who wrote of the Athenian Republic, which had fallen 2,000 years before he wrote, which was 200 years ago, while the original 13 colonies were still part of Great Britain. And I suspect that many of you have heard this. He writes, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves a largesse from the public treasury." In other words, when they realize that they can vote things that give them stuff, that's what's going to dictate how they vote, rather than voting from ideology. "From that moment on, the majority will always vote for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy and is always followed by a dictatorship." Well, that gives you something to look forward to, doesn't it? Do you see any evidence of our heading that direction? I remember when I first read this was 20 some years ago at least, and I was thinking, yeah, this could happen. And now I'm reading and I'm thinking, this is happening. We are there. He says, "The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. These nations have progressed through this sequence, from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from great courage to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependency, from dependency back again into bondage." And there we go. That is where we're headed. That is looking at the practical element. That's not even taking a consideration of the spiritual element, which is the fact that they forgot God in the process. There was a time when they were depending on him, and now they are coming to a place of wanting to depend on the government. And it's because they have put him aside, they have rejected him, and we are in that place of rejecting him as a nation. But the church is still alive and well, I think. Well, generally, though not 100%, because it's being polluted in the process as well. But we don't have to be. There may be an initial impression of genuine goodness. 1 Samuel 9:1 says, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Aphia, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. He's talking about his background. He had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. This initial impression, we may be impressed by physical attractiveness in terms of those people that we want to put in place and have leadership over us. Consider background and heritage. That's what we're told about here. That's attractive to us. Consider external features. He's choice, handsome, tall. We have leaders who get our attention because of whatever attractiveness there is. And because of our media and the visual appeal, that's a significant factor. So we are drawn to the external things and we miss the critical elements of, okay, what does he believe in? Where is he coming from? Where is he taking us? Are we merely impressed with the externality? Then chapter 10, beginning at verse 9, so it was when he had turned his back to go from Samuel that God gave him another heart. This is talking about Saul. And all those signs came to pass that day that he was going to be speaking with the prophets and so on. When they came there to the hill, there was a group of prophets to meet him. Then the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And so this was Saul. This was the new leader. This was the guy who looked good from every human perspective. And there is a spiritual element involved as well. We may be impressed by spiritual attributes. Looking at what he had done and the changes that were taking place. The right heart is needed for a given task. It's interesting that it says in verse 6 that he was going to be another man, and there was going to be a change, and it says that God had given him another heart, which would cause you to wonder, okay, what was wrong with his previous heart? And is he going to revert back to that? And there's evidence that that is the case. The question is, well, where's my heart? Where am I coming from? Or what about those who are leaders? When they tell us where they're coming from in their spiritual perspective, is that correct? Is it consistent? Or are we consistent for that matter? Personal response is still necessary, even with having the Spirit of God, because it says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Now, realizing in Old Testament times the Spirit would come and go, it wouldn't stay in a permanent sense like we have the permanent dwelling of the Spirit in the New Testament culture. And so after Saul, in time, had to make his own decisions, he didn't necessarily rely on the Spirit, and ultimately the Spirit left him as well. We don't have to worry about that, but he did. Then verse 19, but you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said to him, no, set a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and your clans. We may be impressed by official approval. The case here was that God said, okay, go ahead and have a king. But I realize that you're rejecting me in the process. And that was going to have implications. So there was, in effect, special permission that was given. And later in verse 24, it says, the Lord has chosen, when Samuel is telling, the Lord has chosen this person. Now that's interesting to think about. They were asking for someone that God didn't really want them to have, but he said, okay, you can have him. And then God chose someone, and he put that person before them, and he selected someone that would look good to them. Have we been in a similar situation with some of the people that we have had put in place? And he accommodated them, and he essentially said to them, your will be done. But there are consequences. You can do what you want to do against what God wants, and you can get away with it for a time, but there will be consequences. Our nation is discovering that there are consequences, even if we don't necessarily recognize it, but there's a loss of prosperity, a loss of moral foundation, a loss of political power. We see that. It's in process. It's happening. Then there was a pronouncement given, and when the people saw this person, this Saul, who looked good and stood tall, they said, long live the king. There was an enthusiastic reception. And then Samuel, based on God's order to him, gave an explanation about the behavior of royalty. This is the way it's going to be, as we had already looked at, but then it goes on and explains it to them. They got what they wanted. They got what they thought they wanted. How long would that last? How long will it last for us? Several things to think about in all of this. So he took a yoke of oxen. Now this is an occasion where he hadn't officially taken on the responsibility of being king yet, that is Saul. He was still working with the oxen, and there was trouble in the area, and some of the people were being oppressed, and they needed to respond, and the people of Jabesh-Gilead were being threatened, and so Saul said, hey, we're not going to stand for that. And even though he was still plowing a field, it says he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces, saying, whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out. And so he began to rally the troops, if you will, and getting them out to do what had been asked. We may be impressed by practical accomplishments. And so here Saul starts off and is providing some leadership, and the people rally around him. And then in chapter 12, verses 1 through 25, and I'm not going to look at all of these, I'm going to kind of zip right through this, just to note a few things. First of all, it starts off and Samuel says to them, he gives them a validation. Things right here. Yeah, some were impressed by the battle, some were impressed with provisions offered, and then dropping down, chapter 12 and verse 1. Now Samuel said to all Israel, indeed, I have heeded your voice in all that you said to me, and have made a king over you. And now here is the king walking before you, and I am old and gray-headed. And look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day. So Samuel is essentially providing validation, talking about some external expectations here. And he is validating his own authority and his integrity. He said, when I served you, I didn't take anything from you, and I was blameless among you. And so they acknowledge his integrity. No, you didn't take anything. We can trust you. And he's showing why they should listen to him. And then there is a review of previous responses of God's leaders. There was a call to reason in verse 7. He says, now pay attention. Follow me. He talked about Aaron and Moses and some of the others who had come along. And when they got into trouble, you know, they had forgotten God, they got into trouble, and God provided deliverer for them. And then he talks about the requirements of the kingdom. And he said that God is setting this king over you, and there's going to be an expectation of obedience. You need to serve him, or else consequences will follow. And God displayed his power to them through thunder and lightning and provision of rain. And then he called for a response. In verse 20, then Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear, you have done all this wickedness." He told it to him straight. You have abandoned God. You have done this wickedness. Yet, do not turn aside from following. But it's not too late. You can turn around, he's saying. But serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside. For then you would go after empty things which cannot profit and deliver, for they are nothing. Don't go after stuff that's not going to really provide what you need. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you his people. So there was some encouragement there. It says, moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, even though you've gone your own way. I'm not giving up on you, and I will teach you the good and the right way. Now that's interesting to see that put into this particular situation. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth. That is a genuine, heartfelt allegiance to God. That's what he's looking for. That's what he's looking for in the people. And that's what we need to be thinking about. You notice that God didn't say, change your political strategy. He didn't say that. That's what we would expect, wouldn't we? He said, oh, you want a king. That's not the way. Change your political strategy. Change, you know, who you're putting in place. Come up with better leaders. He didn't say that. He said, fix the heart. That's the problem. That's what you need to deal with. That's where we are today. That's what we need to fix as well. And then there is a warning of consequences. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. Beware. Recognize where we're headed. And then just a quick, almost an afterthought to wrap this up. There may be later expression of faulty character. 1 Samuel 13:10 says, now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Here we have an occasion where Samuel didn't show up when Saul thought he should, and things weren't going real well, and they thought, well, they just really needed to have a sacrifice to the Lord and then things will go better in this battle. It's not the first, or it's not the last time that'll happen again. Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed, you didn't keep your schedule, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, that, you know, he panicked, essentially, and decided he better take things into his own hands, which is what he did. A couple of issues here. The problem of impatience. We get a little impatient with how things are going. We get impatient with, you know, why isn't revival coming? Why aren't people doing the things that they ought to be doing in our world? And we may want to take things into our own hands. Or the problem of overstepping bounds. He took on himself doing something that wasn't his place, and there were consequences. And so the result may be abbreviated service, but the cause is a faulty heart. Consequences of our responses. The cure is a commitment in truth. Samuel's commitment didn't transfer. It didn't transfer to his sons. He may have had a true commitment, but it didn't carry over. Of course, there's personal responsibility on the part of the sons. Saul's commitment did not last. He had it for a bit, but it didn't continue. And there was disappointment that came as a result. And the question is, what about your commitment? Will it hold up in difficult times? Is our commitment dependent on circumstances? If the election goes the way that we want it to go, then everything will be okay? If the people are in place in the government that we want to be there, then we will serve with our whole heart. Otherwise, we may be a little half-hearted because we're kind of discouraged, disappointed, because things aren't going our way. When we look around and we see how things are going, it's easy for us to become discouraged. It reminds me of in the film The Two Towers, or in the book The Two Towers by J.R.R. Tolkien, when Frodo, the hobbit, is on the verge of despairing in his mission to destroy the One Ring and save Middle-earth, he turns to his companion, Sam, and says, "I can't do this, Sam." And he's ready to give up. And it's just a point of despair. It's like the way, it's just like, there's just no way. The obstacles are too much. We can't do this. And I appreciate Sam's reply to Frodo. He says, "It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were, and sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come, and when the sun shines, it will shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you, that meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't." And we can look back at our own history and see people who went through difficult times and they stood firm, even though everything looked like it's not going to be possible, because they were holding on to something. And Frodo, in his despair, says, "What are we holding on to, Sam?" And Sam says, "That there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for." And that's still true. There is some good in this world. We know the one who is holding things together, and it's easy for us to be discouraged and to feel like, no, there's just no way. But we can't give up. We have to stand for what's right, because we're not dependent on the circumstances of our political regime. We are countercultural. We are different. We are the church. We are a different entity. We are not overcome. We will overcome the world. That's what Scripture says. We're reminded of that. So we don't have to be discouraged. We ought to be encouraged. As David Lewis said a few minutes ago, 2013 could be the best yet. The darker it gets, the brighter the light shines. The question is, do we have a light to continue to hold up? Are we holding up that light of truth and a commitment to back it up?